Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. Over the years, technological advances have led to progress for people around the world. But others have seen their income and well-being decline. Is the playoff between technology, automation, and jobs an opportunity or a threat? Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/economicengine. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, and Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC, members SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. So there's no shortage of fear right now about the U.S. trade relationship with other countries. You've got President Trump's relentless focus on the trade in goods and on trade deficits. There's new tariffs on steel and aluminum, and the ongoing trade negotiations with the Chinese with hundreds of billions of dollars at stake and the threat of a global trade war. But there's a whole other dimension to the trade picture, and it has to do with national security and a government entity called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. That's a real mouthful. It's also known as CFIUS. And whether foreign governments are buying up access to American technology and possibly data about millions of Americans. And that's what we're going to unpack for you today on Politico Money. And we're joined by Politico's Corey Bennett. Corey, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Ben.
All right. So let's start with something that happened just a little while back. There's a computer chip maker a lot of people have heard of called Qualcomm, and it was the target of a hostile takeover bid. Walk us through what happened with Qualcomm.
Yeah, so it was a pretty big deal, $117 billion at stake there.
Broadcom has lined up $100 billion in debt financing to pay for its hostile takeover bid for Qualcomm. That ratchets up the pressure on Qualcomm's board ahead of a meeting between the companies this week.
And what ended up happening was the committee, as you mentioned, CFIUS, stepped in, recommended to the president that he reject this deal. He stop it from going through. And it was on national security grounds. Essentially, as Trump said when he did decide to axe the deal, he thought that, well, actually, what he said, there is credible evidence that leads me to believe that Broadcom acquiring telecom might take action that threatens to impair the national security of the United States. And how people interpreted that essentially was that the purchase would weaken Qualcomm itself, and thereby the United States. It would have a little more trouble competing with foreign competitors like Huawei. That's been in the news very recently. Huawei is a Chinese company. And the idea is that if we weaken our companies that are building the next generation of wireless technology, I'm thinking about 5G here, for instance, that weakens the U.S. national security. And so that was why the deal was blocked. And it was perhaps not an unprecedented move, but it certainly was the most high profile incident of this to occur to that point. Notably, only the fifth time the president had ever stepped in and done something like this.
Okay, so this was an instance of the government saying this takeover would be a risk to national security on competitiveness grounds. This wasn't actually potential stealing of important technology, right? This was purely
I would say that was part of it too. Sorry to cut in, but with the telecom system very specifically, there is actually a huge concern about espionage, particularly with Chinese telecom firms. Many national security experts and cybersecurity experts that I talk to think that's one of the main ways that companies, foreign companies or foreign governments that have control over these companies could gain a foothold into our network. So, for instance, if the Chinese government has some control, and Broadcom was a Singapore-based company, but Huawei is a Chinese-based company, and members of Congress, members of the intelligence community have been warning lawmakers for a number of years now that a company like Huawei that probably has some sort of affiliation with the Chinese government, we don't know to what degree, but could potentially give Beijing a foothold into America's networks, which might allow them to therefore jump into government networks and pilfer American secrets, both from industrial companies as well as government agencies.
Got it. Okay. So this is how the system is supposed to work. This is how it was designed. This is why CFIUS exists, this government entity, to look at these deals and block them if they're a potential risk to the United States. But as you and your colleague, Brian Bender, and you've been digging into CFIUS now for several months, right?
That's right. Too long.
Your entire lives, you've been looking into CFIUS.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And what you found is that it doesn't always work the way that it's supposed to, that perhaps it's good on some of these big deals, but there's a whole universe of deals that maybe CFIUS is not so good at finding, catching, and preventing on national security grounds. Give us the basic findings in your investigative report.
Well, I think and the committee itself recognizes its own shortcomings, but I think it's very clear, right? When CFIUS was set up in 1975, we knew what critical technology was. It was tanks. It was airplanes. Now, it's a lot harder to know. It's much more complex. And today, any company that holds massive reams of sensitive data is essentially critical infrastructure, and increasingly almost any company holds massive amounts of information on people. And, you know, as a very senior Treasury official put it to us, any time a company has lots of data on Americans, that's of concern to them. But it raises the question, you know, how can CFIUS possibly monitor all of this? So essentially what we were looking at was, you know, they should theoretically be monitoring a lot of stuff, but at this point, they really do not monitor much of these deals that is going on, They're not looking, for example, at investments in startups out in Silicon Valley. They're not looking, for instance, at greenfield investments, which is when a foreign company or a foreign government opens up a business from the ground up in the United States. That's not covered. Low-profile purchases in bankruptcy courts, these are going on all the time, and it's not always clear who is buying whom and who the money man is behind the purchases. That's not really being monitored in any systemic way by CFIUS. They're not monitoring joint ventures where an American company will partner with an overseas company, perhaps on research and development. Those kind of deals are not being purchased. When you are just buying a minority position in a company, that's not necessarily being monitored. So there are just a number of things that by the committee's own admission is not under their purview really to watch, but even they say they probably should be to some degree.
And obviously, the geopolitical landscape has changed a lot. You mentioned the start of CFIUS a long time ago. Ambitions of countries have changed, and particularly China. They've become much more aggressive in their desire to attain American technologies, particularly the initiative that they launched called Made in China 2025. Tell me how that changed, China's ambitions changed what CFIUS really has to do.
Sure. Yeah, the Made in China 2025 document is quite notable and merits a close look because it really did change the way that China was conducting its outbound investing. It essentially directed Chinese investors to look abroad. It proclaimed things like, we will guide enterprises to integrate into local culture. It said, we will support enterprises to perform mergers, equity investment, venture capital investments overseas. That was quite new. Certainly, there was a lot of Chinese money flowing from China outbound to other countries, but it wasn't necessarily being specifically directed. You saw a lot of it going into real estate, into hotels. But there was, under Xi Jinping, there was a concerted effort to start, have some sort of high-level direction for how that money was being spent, and to really put a guiding hand on it, and to focus on certain next-generation technology sectors. I'm thinking robotics, microchips, AI, for instance. Those really jumped to the top of the list, and suddenly you saw all of the investment focused in those areas and many fewer deals in areas like real estate and hotels. And really, that's what we've been seeing since. The amount of Chinese money that was flowing into U.S. tech startups because of that skyrocketed. One of the most notable jumps, I think, is from 2014 to 2015 when they implemented this Made in 2025 plan. Chinese investments in U.S. tech companies went from $2.3 billion in 2014 to $9.9 billion in 2015. That's since come down somewhat as the U.S. has been a little more hesitant to accept that money. But it's still up there, and people say the appetite is still there on China's end. And it's really filled a lot of the desire in the U.S. for startup investment. It's not always there from American investors. And when you are, you know, running to the end of your runway, that can be a huge lifeline for American companies that they're not getting from domestic investors.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you get into this in the piece in a really interesting way, this tension between, you know, U.S. companies, particularly in Silicon Valley, startups that can be starved for capital and really sometimes need that money. And the Chinese come in with giant checkbooks and are willing to help these companies along. And, you know, these can be benign things that are good for American companies getting some foreign investment, but they aren't necessarily that. And the concern is that, you know, this is money that is going to be used by the Chinese to acquire technologies in ways that might not be good for the United States. And that tension is really interesting. I guess I just want to take a step back for a second and say, so what? Like, who cares if the Chinese are trying to invest in U.S. companies? You know, we need the money. Maybe we're not raising enough. These VCs aren't giving our companies enough money, and they wouldn't exist if it weren't for some foreign investors like the Chinese. Like, what are we so scared of? What are the potential bad scenarios here from these deals going through and CFIUS, our government protectors, not stopping them?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate debate, and I don't think it's really settled who is correct in this, because I heard both things. I heard from people I talked to in Silicon Valley, look, you know, we control our technology and we would have gone bankrupt were it not for this money. But the flip side of that, what national security leaders are worried about is that allowing China to invest in these next generation technologies, these are the technologies that 5 and 10 years from now, our government and our military, specifically the U.S. military, is going to be relying on to maintain its military edge globally. And the concern is that if the U.S. allows Chinese guided companies to invest in these technologies, potentially control them, potentially transfer the technology, they will, over time, erode America's military technological edge, America's competitive edge in the global market, and it will allow China to surpass the U.S. Both economically in the sectors that are going to be important 10 years from now, as well as militarily. And I think that's the one that is particularly concerning to national security leaders is the military aspect. The man in charge of CFIUS testified before Congress that he thought it would literally lead to the loss of American lives in future military conflicts. And I think that is the worst case scenario. In addition to some of the potential espionage elements that I've laid out here, I think one of the other concerns, and this is something we did a fair amount of digging on, is that Chinese investors might be putting money into next generation technology companies that then have government contracts with the U.S. government, and that would potentially give Beijing an espionage foothold into U.S. government networks. And we've already seen that Chinese spies are trying very hard to obtain whatever they can from the U.S. government. The OPM hack from, I believe, 2014 comes to mind immediately, and that was when alleged, at least the U.S. government has said, that Chinese spies got into the Office of Personnel Management, stole over 20 million of the most sensitive background check files that we have. These are the, you know, exhaustive 100-plus page sheets that people have to fill out when they're applying for security clearances, top secret security clearances. And they stole all of those. And that gives potentially basically a roadmap to who America's undercover operatives are overseas, who is not actually working for the State Department, as it were. So in addition to the potential military consequences, there's a huge espionage consequence as well. Again, I will say that a lot of these are theoretical concerns, but they are coming from the most senior people in the national security apparatus of the government.
You mentioned at one point, Corey, the man who runs CFIUS, and I don't think we identified who that man is. I now have an image in my head of like Dr. Strangelove in the, you know, by the big board, quashing all these deals because he's afraid the Chinese are going to come and see the big board. Who is the man who runs CFIUS?
No, you got it. You outlined it, but no. Heath Tarbert is the man who's in charge of CFIUS. He's a Treasury Department Assistant Secretary. And, you know, he himself has testified about these some of these concerns in front of Congress. And so Treasury is very on board with the legislation that's moving through. Heath is very on board, and he's been part of kind of trying to raise concerns about this publicly. I would say it's notable that he's doing this. They've said not only is it kind of, you know, something that CFIUS wants that Heath is pushing, it's been described to people I've been talking to on Capitol Hill as one of their top legislative priorities for 2018 is getting this through. So this is really at the top of the list, not just for CFIUS, but for Treasury writ large.
One thing that I found really cool about the piece is that you illustrated how difficult it can be for CFIUS to even know that some of these transactions or a lot of these transactions are going on because they're hidden in bankruptcy courts. They're in places that they wouldn't necessarily be looking. I love the anecdote in there, somebody mentioning CFIUS people are like scouring the Wall Street Journal late at night to find deals that they might want to look at. I mean, this is a whole universe of transactions that you guys try to take a look at that are, you know, hidden from view, particularly in bankruptcy courts. Tell us about the ATOP acquisition as an example of something that you found.
Yeah, the ATOP tech acquisition is a really interesting one that caught the attention of a lot of lawyers who work on CFIUS cases and we were chatting with about. So essentially, in a bankruptcy court up in Delaware, ATOP Tech is this relatively small company, I believe 86 employees when it went under, but it had a $1 billion market share in the electronic design automation sector and integrated circuits markets. You know, it's this very kind of wonky sector, but it's making the kind of things that power our weapon system, that power the power smartphones, for instance. And the person that came in to buy it, or the company, I should say, that came in to buy it, Avatar Integrated Systems, was only set up in March 2017, according to court documents. The person behind Avatar, according to court filings, appeared to be this Hong Kong-based steel magnate named Xinhuan Han. And he is apparently one of China's wealthiest men. We couldn't really track down too much information about him. But people were very concerned about why this company, Avatar, was set up shortly before the purchase. Some believed it was set up exclusively to make the purchase, and why this was not brought to the attention of the authorities. And when people tried to do that, tried to raise warning flags, it did not go through a review, is what we found from CFIUS. Even if the committee might have wanted to, it did not end up getting a review. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen here, but it's very notable that we couldn't find out much about Avatar Integrated Systems. You know, my colleague Brian Bender spent months calling and emailing and cajoling, and we could not get in touch with them, really. And we are left with a lot of questions about why this company, Avatar, wanted ATOP Tech, what they plan to do with the technology and data that they acquired, and what connection, if any, Han, the gentleman behind the company itself, has to the Chinese government. And these are a lot of the questions that I think worry national security folks.
And just to put this in the broadest possible context, I mean, when, you know, the layperson or someone who pays some attention to trade issues and CFIUS thinks about these kind of reviews, they think about, you know, the Chinese or in previous iterations, you know, the Saudis buying up big oil companies in the U.S. or energy companies or hard assets. Like, at least in my experience with it, you think about CFIUS reviews as reviews of foreign companies buying big hard assets in the United States. And really, that's an outmoded way to look at this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought a good illustration of that is how deals have become just much more complex, and it's become much more hard. It just takes more time for CFIUS to get through these things. Like you said, there were very concrete, tangible assets, and they were huge companies that CFIUS was reviewing. It was very obvious when a foreign company was trying to buy, you know, Acme Steel in the U.S. But now, as one former CFIUS official put it to me, deals used to be, you know, these kind of small, slender notebooks that he would get, and now it's a stack of paperwork up to his knee every time one of these goes through. And they don't have the time to be looking through this or the technical expertise to really understand it. We talked to a senior Treasury official who, you know, we asked him, we'd heard a lot about the workload just being kind of overbearing for folks at CFIUS right now. And he said, well, we're able to handle our workload, but we're working most weekends. We never take vacations. We're essentially working Wall Street banker hours plus. And that's just to manage the limited CFIUS mandate that exists currently. If they were to expand it, imagine what would happen then. They certainly don't have the staff to manage that. So there's a question of resources and expertise that goes along with all of this. They're really just not structured to fully review the types of reviews that are, the types of deals, excuse me, that are going through today. It was very much set up to be a kind of classic mergers and acquisitions review board, as we imagined it in the 70s and 80s.
Indeed, they're working Wall Street banker hours without Wall Street banker pay, and they obviously don't have the tools available to them maybe to deal with these giant stacks of paper on all of these deals. Okay, so coming up, what Congress might do about all of this, how we might change the CFIUS process. But first, a quick break.
And now, a word from our sponsor. A message from Morgan Stanley. Is automation a challenge or an opportunity? How will this playoff between automation and jobs develop over time? According to Morgan Stanley, adaptation by policymakers and corporate leaders will be critical to ensure job dislocation and job creation are balanced. Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/economicengine. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, and Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC, members SIPC.
Okay, so all of this is on Congress's radar. The issues with CFIUS are aware that it is an outmoded agency trying to deal with a much more complicated world. Corey, what are some of the specific things that Congress is talking about now to update this agency and to perhaps make it a little bit more effective?
Yeah, so for a number of months now, there have been bills moving through both the House and Senate that would significantly expand the CFIUS mandate, that would get it more resources, get it more personnel, give it even a single line item on the budget, which surprisingly it hasn't had to this point. Each agency has been responsible for providing their own CFIUS budget, which has led to a lot of inconsistency. It would cover a lot of the things we've been discussing. It would expand the mandate to look more at these bankruptcy cases that we're talking about, to look a little more at early stage investing. It would expand the definition of what they should be considering. It would expand the definition of what are known as critical technologies, a somewhat amorphous term, but it's intended to pull in these kind of next generation AI, things that are still budding and emerging, but we are able to identify them as kind of what's going to be important down the road. It would allow them to look at a lot more things. It would mandate that people file in certain instances. It would streamline the filing system so people would be more inclined to file. Notably right now, there's no requirement for any company to alert CFIUS to a deal that's going on. It's a voluntary process right now, and this wouldn't completely change it, but it would incentivize companies through different processes to file. So it would address a lot of what we're talking about. Notably, it wouldn't address some things, and it has had considerable pushback from the business community, from some people on Capitol Hill.
Got it. Okay, so of course there's pushback. There's always pushback on these
things.
That's
right, yeah.
And you guys laid it out pretty well in the article that a lot of it is coming from the technology industry. I mean, surprise, surprise, they don't necessarily want more hurdles to jump through on their deals or a sense that a very important source of money could get cut off from them. What are the arguments they make? I was sympathetic to some of them that, you know, you're going to add a whole bunch of paperwork for deals that might not really be that controversial at all, you know, chase off Chinese money and make it harder to innovate and to get new technologies and products. So basically, what does big tech or small tech or all tech say Congress is in danger of doing here?
Yeah, I think there's some fear about the unintended consequences here. in addition to some of these passive investments that you're mentioning. I mean, these are very small-scale investments that are occurring all around Silicon Valley. We looked at one in particular in the piece. It was an artificial intelligence company, and they got their initial boost from Tencent, which is a Chinese company. It was $200,000, and they were about to go out of business, and they got this kind of lifeline here for $200,000. They didn't have to give up any sort of control over the technology. It was essentially just a very passive investment, and that has allowed them to now grow rapidly over the next 3 years. And it notably beget American investment. Once there was kind of this initial investment that buoyed the company, American investors were suddenly lining up. So it's kind of this instance of a Chinese investment actually sparking the American economy down the road. And as he said, you know, all our code is open sourced. Me and my American co-founder are 100% in control, he told me. And so these are the kind of passive investments that he fears and that entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley fear are going to be scared off as a result of this bill, even if it's not necessarily meaning that all of these investments are subject to CFIUS review. It does mean that there's potential fear of it. It does mean, and the bill, one thing it would do is expand from 30 to 45 days the timeline of the CFIUS review. And that's to address some of the things we were talking about, the, you know, paperwork up to your knee. But the, you know, the countervailing force there is that a lot of these early stage Silicon Valley investments are turned around in a matter of days and weeks, not months. And so do people want to wait for that potential timeline? And what happens if the Chinese go away? While, you know, VC funding is still going up overall, it has dipped in certain periods. You know, I believe it was from late 2015 to early 2016. Investments in startups, VC funding dipped considerably. And that essentially has been replaced by these Chinese billionaires putting their own money into Silicon Valley as American investors are getting more tight-fisted. So there's some concern that you're essentially killing the goose that lays the golden egg a little bit with this bill, not specifically by regulating all of these deals, by simply injecting this kind of threat, this specter, this looming possibility that things are going to be killed. Then there's also the concerns from kind of bigger tech, if we're going to separate. And they're a little more concerned about some of the vagaries. I talked about the term critical technologies, right? They fear that this is kind of using, what was it, the Supreme Court case about pornography, we know it when we see it. They fear that that's the approach they're taking to critical technologies here. They're not going to define it, and so it could mean everything or nothing. And there's also some concerns about joint partnerships, joint ventures that I referenced earlier, that those are actually already create some duplicative regulations going on because those are also under an export controls regulatory scheme. And some of that has been addressed by changes that have been made in the bill. Some of it has not been addressed. But those are essentially the broad contours. But there is some warning from the business community that are we ready for CFIUS to jump from a couple hundred investigations a year to a few thousand investigations a year? And does the bill give them the resources to do that? And I think that remains an open question.
Okay. And just give us a sense before we let you go exactly how CFIUS works, because you lay it out in the piece that it's not, you know, one specific agency. Treasury takes the lead here, but there are people from a variety of departments who take part in CFIUS and contribute to its funding, in fact. So just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of CFIUS, how it's organized.
That's right. So Treasury is kind of, you know, the organizer, the orchestrator overseeing it. But there are significant teams at other agencies, including DHS, within the intelligence community, over at Commerce. And they have, well, it depends agency to agency, but at Treasury right now, there are about 20 to 30 people working on CFIUS, and that's kind of a high watermark for them. They've been adding staff. Over at the Department of Homeland Security, there's probably 10 to 20. We don't really have an exact figure there, but that's what past CFIUS officials were telling us, and probably less at other agencies. So they have to really source their information during their investigations from a lot of different places. They have to tap into the intelligence community. They have to tap DHS. They have to tap Commerce. I mean, they're dealing with a lot of complex things and a lot of expertise that's not housed under Treasury itself. So they're really having to go to a lot of different places. And historically, it's been up to different agencies, including the Pentagon, to really determine how much effort they want to put into it or how much intelligence they want to share or pass along. And so it's really been kind of a herding cats structure for a long time, as it was described to us. And, you know, you can imagine nine agencies, I think, in any process is probably not a pleasant experience. And this seems to have fallen into that camp for a lot of time, even though it is, by all accounts, you know, filled with very knowledgeable and hardworking individuals. Just by its very structure, it's not necessarily a smooth, clean functioning machine.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't sound like it, and it didn't come off that way in the piece that you guys wrote. Not that they're not working very hard and very dedicated to what they do, but it does feel very kind of ad hoc, get information where you can, work, you know, 24/7 to try to figure all of this stuff out.
Yeah, I think a good quote I got from one ex-CFIUS official was, we had to pick up some intelligence here, some technology assessment there, some industrial analysis hither.
That jumped off the page at me too. I saw hither and I was like, wow, that does not sound like the well-oiled machine you necessarily want trying to make sure that the Chinese or others are not taking all our military technology to eventually take us over and subjugate us. Not that they're going to do that, but you know, these are the fears that people have. The congressional changes, the you know, reform of CFIUS that's going through, and does that address manpower and funding for CFIUS? Like, do they get more people and more money?
It does. It would get them more personnel, a larger budget, and notably, as I mentioned, it would be one line item on the budget, so they could request a kind of top level, here's what we want for CFIUS in totality, not what we want for this little corner of CFIUS. And so I do think it would address a lot of those issues. And this is one point that John Cornyn, the Senate Majority Whip, makes a lot, is that, you know, while we think it requires a lot of money in the grand scheme of things, it's probably the cost of one fighter jet to get CFIUS where it needs to be. So it's really just a matter of thinking about it in scale and putting it in a little kind of perspective there. So it would address some of the resource concerns. Whether it addresses all of the resource concerns, I think people are still undecided on that.
Well, government never thinks that it's got all the resources that it needs, but it certainly sounds like CFIUS could use a little bit more, and maybe these guys won't have to work every weekend, all weekend anymore. Corey Bennett and Brian Bender have a terrific piece on CFIUS and the problems with it on Politico. Highly recommend that you go and read that and get up to speed on all these important issues. Corey, thank you so much for joining Politico Money.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
That's a wrap for this week's Politico Money. Thanks so much to Corey Bennett for joining us. Thanks to my producer, Micaela Rodriguez. Our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. We'll be back with you next week.